The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, December 2018, Volume 19, Number 12. And this is the second of what will be three installments of the December issue. It's the Christmas special, Oprah's Favorite Things issue. And on this month's cover, Oprah is the angel sitting on the top of a Christmas tree. This tree is made of beautifully wrapped Christmas presents, stacked up like a pyramid. They are wrapped in green and red and blue and purple with big bows and gold trim. And Oprah's wearing a red and gold sequin dress. And let's look behind the scenes on this cover shoot. That's a wrap, says the heading. On this month's cover, Oprah celebrates the most wonderful time of the year atop a plethora of presents. You may be curious, how did our cover model, decked in a glimmering floor-length gown and embellished pomps, ascend that tower of gifts? Well, the truth is she didn't have to. She just sat pretty on a few boxes, and the rest was digital magic. It's a good thing. The rainbow of gifts designed by set magician Stephen Brown was held up with some glue dots and a prayer. Oprah appreciates a beautiful present, but says the best gift is, quote, when people come together and make memories, end of quote. No wrapping required. And we have some snapshots here. One, Oprah is surrounded by her hair and makeup artists, and while she has on this glamorous red sequined gown, she's wearing some definitely business-like glasses. And then in the next scene, she's sitting atop what are just a few boxes. And then another snapshot shows the stack of gifts minus Oprah. From the top, it's all hands on set as fashion editor Jenny Capitan adjusts earrings and hairstylist Nicole Mangrum shapes Oprah's waves. Capitan keeps ribbon in a holding pattern because Oprah's holding a ribbon as if she's just unwrapped a box on the cover. And Stephen Brown and Brian Crabtree of Glitterville position the gifts. And now to sort of recreate the glitter glamour of Oprah's outfit, we have some fashion suggestions under the heading A Shining Example, Standout Pieces for Making Spirits Bright. In the center is a top from Talbots for $189, and it is a black sequined sort of tunic-length top, three-quarter-length sleeves, and a large, a wide bateau neck. Below that, we have some red velvet slingback skinny-heeled shoes embellished on the toe with some diamond-like stones. These are $475 at sarahflint.com. There's a skinny pencil skirt that falls way below the knee from zara.com, and it's $50. Again, sequins. It is a soft pink with a black and white plaid on it. Then there are some silver sequined pants from Millie.com for $325. And in a dress that harkens a bit back to the 1970s look from Rixo London for $575, it's a red striped full-length dress. It has kind of a tight jewel neck, and the stripes are horizontal on the bodice. But then the skirt kind of comes to a point in kind of an ampere waistline, and the sequined stripes meet in the middle in kind of a chevron-like pattern. So you have this point that comes up just below the bust line, Now, what gives it that kind of 70s look is the sleeves are full and gathered and just above the elbow. So that's $575 from netaporter.com. And Oprah's opening comments in the Here We Go section of the magazine are, what is your talent? Are you a brilliant conversationalist, a mechanical whiz, a fabulous chef, a writer, a financial planner? Or does your strength lie in your dedication, your gumption, your desire to pitch in any way you can? Whatever your answer to this question, one thing is certain. Your particular skills and abilities can help better the world. All you have to do is put those gifts to good use, like the generous people you'll meet starting on page 144. Speaking of people who've made a world of difference, I recently had the enormous pleasure and privilege of interviewing Michelle Obama at the Hearst Tower, where the O offices are located. In our in-depth conversation, she speaks candidly about growing up on the south side of Chicago and the highs and lows of life in the White House, not to mention what it's like being married to Barack Obama. You won't want to miss it, or her new memoir, Becoming, which I've chosen as my latest Oprah's Book Club selection. I hope other book clubs select it too. I loved every page of it, and I believe everyone ought to give it a read. And what would the holidays be without gifts? Much less fun, that's what. So in the spirit of the season, head over to page 43 to find 107 presents approved by yours truly. It's better to give than to receive, they say. I can't help but agree, especially if what you're giving comes from the heart. Enjoy, Oprah. And we dove right into Oprah's favorite things, the holiday edition, in the first installment. So now we are going to go to the holidays according to Gail. And the first picture we have from Gail is she's dressed up in a red sweater that has presents on the front. She's got on a green elf hat with a little red pointy cuff around it. And she has on a string of those old-fashioned big Christmas lights as a necklace. She's holding an ornament up to a Christmas tree. And she's holding an old-fashioned album, Merry Christmas, from Johnny Mathis. Gail says, I love everything about the holidays. Dressing up for parties, exchanging gifts, sipping eggnog. I can't count points all the time. But what I really treasure are the family traditions. For instance, my house is neither merry nor bright until Johnny Mathis's 1958 Merry Christmas album starts playing and we're all singing along to Sleigh Ride. In the next few pages, I'll share a few more of my customs, along with some gathered from O staffers. I hope you'll find something worth adding to your traditions. Now let's get this holiday started. And next, she says, one of my favorite things, giving Broadway tickets to friends who don't usually get to see musicals on the Great White Way. This year, I've already picked the must-see performance, The Cher Show. It's a glitzy, 35-tune-filled look at the iconic singer's life, channeling her and her boundary-pushing in three different eras. It's being described as part coming-of-age tale, part love story, and part costume extravaganza. I can't wait to turn back time and give the gift of gypsies, tramps, and thieves. And we have a contribution here from O's Director of Marketing and Promotion, Ashley O'Brien Riley. And she says, every Christmas Eve, my family sings All I Want for Christmas Is You by Mariah Carey. Over and over. None of us know the actual lyrics, but the performances get better as the wine keeps flowing. It's become such a staple that I even asked my wedding band to learn it, and I got married in August. The world, according to Gail, is expanded for December. So we turn the page and we have more from Gail. And we have a scene of five grown-ups wearing red and white striped pajamas sitting on a sofa with a, in a two-story soaring ceiling section of a house with a Christmas tree to fill that. So let's look at the description of this picture. Gail says, when my favorite son, Will, lived in China, he'd come back bearing unique gifts, from brocade vests to fancy chopsticks. And just like that, a tradition was born. Now we always try to give each other unexpected things. Two Christmases ago, Oprah really got us with these matching striped pajamas. We had a good laugh and an even better photo op. What'll it be this year? Matching sombreros? Furry clogs? I can't wait to see what they come up with. So Gail is standing with her favorite son, Will, behind the sofa. And we have Oprah sitting with two young women. I'm guessing one of these is Kirby, Gail's favorite daughter. There's a picture here from the newest Rocky movie. And Gail says, another holiday season, another movie screening at Oprah's house. My request this year, Creed 2, out November 21st, the sequel to 2015's critically acclaimed Rocky reboot. This time around, Adonis Johnson, played by Michael B. Jordan, is back with his beloved coach, Rocky Balboa, the one and only Sylvester Stallone. And ready to fight, Victor Drago, the son of the fighter who killed his father, Apollo Creed, in the ring. Whether Adonis wins or loses, this movie will be a total KO. Now we have some contributions here from more Oprah staffers. Christina McMahon, associate publisher in marketing, says, my brother has family over for a gingerbread house making competition. The kids have built MetLife Stadium, Rockefeller Center, and the Wizard of Oz's Yellow Brick Road, all in hopes of winning an iTunes gift card. But I think the real prize is bragging rights. Felicia Kinsey, Advertising Services Director, says, for the last 23 years, my husband and I have hosted a game night during the holidays for family and friends. Now it's become a three-day event. We especially love what we call the reindeer antler game. Each team has to inflate balloons, stuff them inside a pair of pantyhose, and then place them on someone's head like antlers. The first team to finish wins a prize, and everyone in antlers is forced to parade around the house and pose for embarrassing pictures. Oh my gosh, and she has pictures of two little children here, and I think this is one adult. They've blown the balloons up, not in any special shapes like animal balloons, but just regular balloons. Stuffed them in stockings as she talked, and then put them upside down so that the waist of the stockings are like a headband. And then these legs full of balloons are just sort of shimmying above their heads. On the next page, under the heading Travel, for years, Gail says, my family was always home for the holidays in Greenwich, Connecticut. We liked being near our own tree. But when my favorite kids turned into my favorite adults, we started spending Christmas with Oprah and Stedman in Hawaii. Now, when Oprah and Stedman travel, we go with. We've been everywhere from Fiji, where we reenacted scenes from Finding Nemo in a pool meets fish tank, to Colorado, where everyone skis and I stay close to the bunny slope. We have fun no matter where we roam, but my fingers are crossed that we go somewhere warm this year. And we have a picture of Gail and Kirby and Will in a fish tank that's sort of above ground. There's a glass wall on one end of it, and then it's in this shallow, almost like wading pool. And then there's a picture in the snow on a ski slope. We have a contribution from Christina Weber, executive photo director. There's a snapshot of her and a couple of other women with a Santa Claus. Christina says, when my friend moved back to London in 2015, I decided to visit her every December to keep our connection strong despite the distance. It's a great way to kick off the season. We just catch up and see her city at its most beautiful. And now we have another contribution from Gail here, and we're looking at, down at a picture of pies. There are 9 of them. One has a lattice top, one has a regular crust top, and then the others look really scrumptious. There's a pecan pie, a chocolate chess pie. Let's see what Gail says. I'm a cake girl by nature. My motto, the more icing, the better. So who would have guessed that a southwestern taco pie could give frosting a run for its money? These personal-sized treats are either savory, like chicken pot pie, spinach mushroom quiche, and tomato, or sweet, like French coconut custard, apple, and cherry. The best part, they can be shipped anywhere in the contiguous U.S. So if you can't be with the ones you love, send your loved ones some pie. $60 to $65 for 6 at southernbakedpie.com. Christine Potter Mulhern, the advertising style director, says, whenever my family went on vacation when I was a girl, we'd buy an ornament to represent the trip. I think the collection started because my parents wanted my siblings and me to have trinkets that could one day decorate our own trees. And when my son visited Ireland this summer, he brought an ornament, a snow globe with a leprechaun inside, back for my mom. The tradition lives on. And the final page of the holidays, according to Gail, and there's a snapshot of Gail sitting with her 2 kids when they were very, very young. They're sitting on the hearth of a stone fireplace. Gail says, I wanted Kirby and Will to learn at an early age the importance of sharing, not just with each other, but everyone. So when they were little, I'd ask churches to share the wish lists of local families in need. My kids and I would shop for everything on the lists, from Game Boys to bicycles, and deliver them on Christmas Day. You know the saying, it's better to give than to receive? It's true, and Kirby and Will can back me up on that. And then Gail goes on to say, how do you celebrate what would have been Nelson Mandela's 100th birthday? You honor his legacy of fighting for equality. On December 2nd, Global Citizen will do just that with a concert called Global Citizen Festival Mandela 100. Its goals are to inspire a new generation to follow in the Nobel Peace Prize winner's footsteps and end extreme poverty by 2030. With a mission this important, it wasn't hard to get Trevor Noah to host, superstars like Beyonce and Jay-Z, Chris Martin and Ed Sheeran to perform, and Oprah to give a special presentation. It'll be a night to remember. Jane Jamison, SVP, Publisher and Chief Revenue Officer, says, everyone gets a menorah. I collect them and pass them out at the table. It's a true festival of lights. Jill Armis, the design director, contributes, growing up, my daughter Gina learned about the spirit of Hanukkah by donating to Toys for Tots and adopting animals from World Wide Fund for Nature. Since then, she's created her own generous traditions, like donating her hair in 2006. For one birthday, she asked for contributions to the Allie Forney Center, an LGBTQ nonprofit in New York City. For her bat mitzvah, she donated 25% of her gift money to Charity Water, which provides people in developing nations with clean water. I'm so glad she's embraced the power of giving. And there's a picture of her sitting at the hairdresser's chair with her blonde hair. She's a cute little girl, maybe 9 or 10 years old. And the hairdresser's holding her hair in a ponytail, getting ready to cut it. Now, next up, let's read the answers contributed by readers to this month's question. What's the most thoughtful gift you've ever received? Jean Pryor of Los Angeles says, "My 13-year-old brother used his paper route money to buy me a beautiful coat that I loved but my family couldn't afford. I still tear up thinking of that Christmas morning." Fran Rushing of Kirkland, Indiana says, "As a teacher, I wore a gold apple pendant necklace every day until I gave it to my daughter when she got her teaching degree. My husband surprised me with a replica of that necklace so my daughter and I could both have one." Barry Zukal of Waldorf, Maryland says, "When we married, I gave my husband a block of wood. He said it was beautiful but too hard to carve. 10 years later at Christmas, he gave me that block of wood carved into a bird in flight." Barbara McSween of Zephyr Cove, Nevada says, "I am a city girl living in the mountains. When a squirrel got into our house, I called my husband at work. He hurried home and chased it out. A gift better than flowers." Donna Liebman, Weymouth, Massachusetts, writes, "A yellow posted on my computer screen from my then 5-year-old daughter that reads, 'I love you more than cake.' I still have it 35 years later." And finally, Frances Conwell of Philadelphia writes, "In the midst of a full sweat-pouring hot flash, a 6-year-old student took my hand and walked me to a fan." In the section of the magazine that has the special topic for the month, I'm always amazed at the creativity of the folks at Oprah for finding a way to make an Oprah O in some kind of pictorial way. And this month we have a snow-covered lawn in front of a brick house, the porch lights on, there's garland around the columns, there's a wreath on the door, and there are some of those deer, those lighted deer, one standing upright looking over its left shoulder and the other one sort of grazing on the ground. And in between the two deer is one of those sort of wire, they're almost meshy-like with lights, is a great big Oprah O. And let's read, "What is your gift to give? A special skill, an ardent passion, time, money, a pair of hands. Whatever you have to offer, know the simple truth. It can do real and lasting good. Meet a few generous folks who've discovered just how great an impact one person's efforts can make." And our first contribution is from Elizabeth Choi. "Righting wrongs," as in W-R-I-T-I-N-G. "A poet advocates self-expression to those who sorely need it." Elizabeth writes, "On a March day in 2009, Pamela Hart and her then 23-year-old son, Will, stood in a line of tourists outside Mount Vernon, George Washington's stately Virginia home. Suddenly, Will turned to his mother and said matter-of-factly, 'I'm thinking of joining the army. What would you say to that?' Hart, an accomplished poet who's rarely at a loss for words, was speechless. As they shuffled between rooms in the home of the country's first commander-in-chief, Will talked about duty and avoiding the drudgery of a desk job. He'd been a confident, athletic kid, always in the thick of things. But the army? As Hart, 65, says now, quote, 'I wasn't against it, but I couldn't wrap my mind around it,' end of quote." In 2010, when American military deaths in Afghanistan peaked, Will headed to basic training. Hart's confusion turned to dread. She got a tattoo on her wrist of a Tibetan symbol of understanding and creativity and vowed to use both to withstand her fear. She'd search for a way to, quote, "put good karma into the world," end of quote, through her love of words. Maybe Hart hoped that karma would shine back onto her son. Through an internet search, she found the Afghan Women's Writing Project, AWWP, which conducts online writing workshops in English. Only about 17% of Afghan women are literate, and far fewer know English. Yet nearly 100 have participated in the program since it began almost a decade ago. In a country where women's education is severely suppressed, AWWP cautiously recruits participants through word of mouth. Many of the riders, particularly those in Taliban-held areas, must hide their work from family and neighbors. Some walk hours to use a computer at an internet cafe. Hart decided to get involved, becoming a workshop leader for the organization. Each week, she emailed workshop members a different prompt: write about your family, a food you love, and then sent back poems, and they sent back poems for critique. Whatever the topic, the specters of war and violence shadowed their work, yet Hart saw themes that surprised her, saying, quote, "We have a stereotype of what an Afghan woman might write," end of quote, such as tales of oppression and sexism. But she goes on to say, quote, "But it's not always what you expect," end of quote. In one poem, a woman named Hila addressed an imagined extraterrestrial, saying, quote, "I look at the night sky, wondering about you," end of quote. When Will went to Ranger School and deployed to Afghanistan, Hart attended a support group for military families. In a Red Cross classroom, she met women on the American side of war. Mothers confused by jargon their children used in crackling phone calls from distant bases. Wives holding babies, wondering aloud whether it was better to read the news or avoid it. Here, too, Hart turned to poetry. She wrote poems based on her experiences, and after interviewing the group's members, on theirs as well. And she thought poetry might offer similar succor to those who had served on the front lines. As Hart says, quote, "Poetry helps you figure out how you feel," end of quote. In 2016, Hart became poetry editor for Military Experience and the Arts, a nonprofit that helps veterans and family members put their lives into words. 2 years earlier, Will had returned from deployment. She's since pored over verses about everything from shrapnel to friendships formed on the battlefield, selecting the best for publication. In one standout piece, a woman named Lisa Stice writes, "My husband asks if I heard the news, and I say yes. We are quiet for a long while. Then I ask if he knew any of them, and he says yes." Hart is also publishing a book of poems, Mothers Over Nangarhar, inspired by her work. A few years ago, around Veterans Day, Hart organized a workshop called Soldier Stories at the Kadenaw Museum of Art in New York, where she's an arts educator. Veterans viewed war-themed art, wrote what came to mind, then read their work aloud. A gentleman with gray hair clipped short under an American Legion cap was one of the first to go, starting with a nervous apology, quote, "This isn't much," end of quote. He told a story about patrolling the Mekong Delta during the Vietnam War, his boat cutting through the water, his friends alongside him. The audience laughed sometimes, went silent at others. The man began to relax. When he finished reading, he smiled, and he said, quote, "Thanks for listening. I'm glad I had a chance to write this down," end of quote. Then he passed the microphone to the next vet. Now, the next piece is called Wild Work. At animal sanctuaries across America, volunteers offer help out of sheer love for creatures in need. The Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California, has pools full of fauna rescued on the Pacific coast. Fur seals, sea lions, harbor seals, speckled as swallows' eggs. Some were separated from their mothers, others injured, but after recovering, all will return to the sea. It's feeding time, so here comes a man in hip waders toting chunks of herring, part of the half ton of fish cut up at dawn. One malnourished pup must take his in smoothie form. The person feeding him is a volunteer, like the guy in Waiters and the Fish Choppers. Says the center's spokesperson, Laura Shear, there's a lot of work to do. A lot. Meanwhile, in Keensburg, Colorado, a docent stands on a platform 30 feet above a tiger habitat. The cats look serene, as do the grizzlies in the pen across the way. The docent tells some visitors that the Wild Animal Sanctuary is home to rescues from circuses, zoos, and naive pet owners. Quick PSA, tiger cubs grow up. That docent, a volunteer, as is the person weeding near an alpaca pen. At safe havens around the U.S., willing lay folk care for wild animals. The commitment is intense. A 6-month minimum may be required. The job's often dirty, forming beef balls for big cats, hosing off poolside poops. At Wachula, Florida's Center for Great Apes, home to 52 rescued orangutans and chimps, helpers may train for upwards of 2 months to do tasks like prepping produce. If you think the payoff is VIP access to the animals, you're wrong. The Wild Animal Sanctuary enforces a 10-foot rule, and Marine Mammal Center helpers work while holding up wooden shields for safety. And because some pinnipeds habituate quickly to humans, a potential danger back on the beach. Patty Reagan, the Center for Great Apes founder, says, quote, "We don't have animals you can hold and pet, so knowing you're making a difference has to be enough," end of quote. For some, it is. At each of these havens, volunteers routinely overshoot their commitments. Shear says, quote, "Many have been here for decades," end of quote. The next article is called "Your Present is Requested. A Charitable Gift Can Accomplish a Lot." There are, to be blunt, so many sadnesses in the world. Hunger and loss, war and crime, lack of access, options, infrastructure. And you can provide so many small, meaningful solutions via a gift bought in the name of a loved one and sent where it's needed. Heifer International has all but made giving a cow, $500, a seasonal tradition. But don't feel bound to bovines or that organization. There are smaller animals, a goat and 2 chickens, $110. There are much smaller animals, a beehive plus a beekeeping suit and training, $60. There's a vegetarian option, the makings of a fruit and veggie garden, $40. The bibliophile's bliss, stock a U.S. library, $400. Or the pedalist's preference, $85 sends a bicycle to someone who needs transportation to work. Then there are the not-so-adorable selections, which shouldn't go ungiven for being less dear than a trio of ducks, $30, incidentally. Give a family reeling from disaster, natural or man-made, the comfort and dignity of cleanliness. A kit of daily basics, toothbrushes, soap, etc., $40. Stave off malaria, a pair of mosquito nets, also $40. Offer a community fresh water. Your contribution toward a village's well and hand pump, $150. Or a child maimed by landmines, a wheelchair, $50. Or buy dung. Yes, dung, $12. Do you know what magic manure can do? It expends crop yields, obviates the need for chemical fertilizer, and can be the difference between some food and enough food. Reckoning with need, immense, tragic need, around the world is difficult. You cannot gift by gift save every soul, but you can save one or five or a dozen with just a little cash. $18, water jugs for 3 families. Or $50, a backpack, a notebook, and other supplies for a girl attending school for the first time. Or $75, peanut paste, to return a malnourished child from the brink. That is not nothing. In fact, to someone, it's everything. And here are the organizations' websites that you can go to for these gift suggestions. heifer.org, worldvision.org, savethechildren.org, oxfamgifts.org. And next, a final note. As people face the end of their lives, these heavenly choirs ease their fear and pain. In 1990, Kate Munger, a Northern California elementary school music teacher, visited her friend Larry, who was dying of AIDS. She weeded his garden, she washed the dishes. Then she entered the bedroom to sit with him. The room was bright and airy, full of plants and colorful quilts he'd sewn. In the bed lay Larry, comatose but agitated. Munger was unnerved, unsure how to be useful. So she did what came naturally. She sang. She chose a simple song called Hello Moon. There's a moon, there's a star in the sky. There's a cloud, there's a tear in my eye. There's a light, there's a night that is long. There's a friend, there's a pain that is gone. She began softly, tentatively, and as she sang, Larry stopped driving. She continued for 2.5 hours. 4 days later, Larry died. Munger says, quote, I felt that if I could be calm through the music, I could somehow communicate that calmness. It was the best gift I could give at the time. End of quote. A preacher's daughter who grew up singing in choirs, Munger began to nurse an idea. A genre of music geared toward the dying, a songbook for those at their end. It wasn't until 10 years later, once she turned 50, aware more than ever of her own mortality, that she acted on that thought. Having led community choruses in and around Marin County for years, in 2000, Munger emailed a select group of singers to gauge their interest. 15 women showed up for the initial practice, and the Threshold Choir was born. Today it has 160 chapters in the United States and several in Canada, Europe, Australia, and Southeast Asia. Hospice workers, nurses, and chaplains spread the word about the choir's existence. Before visiting a hospice patient, singers try to learn about his or her musical preferences, spiritual orientation, physical capacity, and ability to communicate. But the vast majority of the choir songs are original, with repetitive lyrics. They sound like Gregorian chants. Munger wrote the choir's go-to song, You Are Not Alone, whose 6 lines, sung in 3-part harmony, are simple yet profound. You are not alone, I am here beside you. You are not alone, I am here now. I am not alone. You are here beside me. We are not alone. We are here together. In groups of 2 or 3, choir members drift into a room, stay for about 20 minutes, then drift out again, still singing. The effect of their voices on the dying is stunning. Heart rate slow, breathing deepens. Patients who have otherwise been non-responsive may smile, move a foot, even shed a tear. These reactions underscore the belief that hearing is the last sense to lapse before death. Choir members return weekly, sometimes for months, until the patient dies. Most volunteers join the group after experiencing its positive effects firsthand. Such was the case with Susan Garrett, co-director of the Marin Threshold Choir. As her father lay dying in Minnesota, a local chapter sang to him and Garrett was moved. Growing up poor, she and her 5 siblings harmonized as a pastime. Something about the idea of singing as solace felt right. Inevitably, some choirs are present as the patient's life comes to an end, and in these moments, extraordinary things have happened. The non-responsive awaken, the distressed go still. After the final breath is taken, it is sometimes followed by a strange, suspended silence. And then, often, all that remains is relief. We have a couple of more contributions in this section. And the next to the last one is called Daughter of the Soil. A passionate legal mind uses the law and her family history to save imperiled farmers. On a humid South Carolina evening last summer, agricultural attorney Jillian Hishaw stood exhausted beside an empty truck bed. That afternoon, she'd visited a church and the Florence branch of the Harvest Hope Food Bank, making much-needed food deliveries. On her long rounds, she'd personally dropped off 100 watermelons, more than 1,200 pounds total, that would go to communities where fresh produce is a luxury. The fruit was grown at Gamble Family Farms, a small operation about 45 miles down the road in Sumter. Because Hishaw is not only bringing food to the hungry, she's also helping farmers, many of whom, like her, are African American, stay in business. As she puts it, quote, "My heart bleeds for the small farmer," end of quote. Hishaw's grandfather was raised on a small farm in Oklahoma with chickens, pigs, and produce. When he and his mother left the area, they entrusted the farm's tax payments to a lawyer who, they later learned, pocketed the money. Soon the farm was sold to pay a tax lien. Farmers losing their land is sadly still common. In just 2016 and 2017, approximately 20,000 American farms shut down or were consolidated. Historically, black farmers have been particularly vulnerable. The seminal class action lawsuit, Pickford versus Glickman, which Hishaw watched unfold while an undergraduate at Tuskegee University, brought this vulnerability into sharp relief. Filed in 1997 by Timothy Pickford and 400 fellow plaintiffs, the suit alleged that the U.S. Department of Agriculture had discriminated against African-American farmers for years by denying them loans to expand their operations, pay off debts, purchase necessary machinery, or disaster relief similar to that afforded their white counterparts. The plaintiffs prevailed. Just over $1 billion was paid to more than 15,000 farmers. And later in 2010, a second settlement awarded an additional $1.2 billion to farmers who had missed the original deadline. In what remains one of the biggest civil rights settlements in American history. Watching the USDA be held accountable for its discrimination galvanized Hishaw. She says, quote, "I knew then I would start a nonprofit for farmers of color," end of quote. In 2013, Hishaw founded Family Agriculture Resource Management Services, FARMS, an organization that provides pro bono legal counsel to aging farmers across the country to help them keep their land. FARMS also helps relieve hunger in those farmers' communities by raising money to purchase their produce, then giving it to local food pantries. To date, Hishaw has donated 265,000 pounds of produce across 8 states. Hishaw built her legal acumen working as a consultant. She helped farmers file claims in the second Pickford suit, and for the Department of Agriculture before establishing FARMS. Her knowledge of the field, so to speak, pays off in astonishing ways. LaTanya Williams came to Hishaw in 2015 when her Chester, South Carolina, alpaca farm faced foreclosure. Williams had recently inherited the farm, but its deed remained in the name of her family's former slaveholder, so she couldn't apply for federal grants. Hishaw and a colleague worked to get the document updated. Though Hishaw works with volunteers, she spends most of her time managing her considerable to-do list herself. She says, quote, "I'm just trying to make sure I stay afloat," end of quote. But when she meets with farmers on their land or delivers their produce to a food bank, she says, quote, "It rejuvenates me. Every time I do this, it reminds me why I do this." And now our last contribution in this section. hitting the old dusty trail. What helps a long-distance hiker keep on keeping on? Food, shelter, and care from a few new friends. They go by names like Scout, Frodo, Sundance. They whip up pancakes and meadows, dispense freshly brewed iced tea. They're trail angels, Samaritans who provide unexpected delights, or as they call it, trail magic to long-distance hikers whose journeys often last weeks. Stephen Scarano, Hamburger Helper, is one of dozens of angels on the Pacific Crest Trail, a 2,650-mile route along the West Coast. Being an angel, Scarano says, is about offering comfort, food, minimal medical care, a kind word or a joke, even a place to crash. Raven doles out fresh strawberries. Dr. Soul bandages blisters. Three guesses how he earned his name. Jeff and Donna softly lend their Agua Dulce, California home, known as Hiker Heaven, as a place to rest one's head, have mail forwarded, and enjoy dinner while doing laundry for free. Scarano, a 71-year-old retired cop, first greeted hikers with his wife, Emmy, in 2007, loading a backpack with McDonald's. He says, quote, "Our friends Marty, Reaper, and Norma, Hot Pants, were passing through with a bubble." That's a cluster of hikers, so we packed extra, end of quote. When he saw how well the grub went over, Scarano knew he'd found his calling. He kept the burgers coming. He says, "I converted a lot of vegetarians." Though these days, he and his crew mostly stick to PB&Js, much more cost-effective. Scarano and his pals carry spare insoles, shoelaces, anything that might be useful. Now and then, they don goofy adhesive mustaches to brighten a weary hiker's day. He says, quote, "We bring an orange tarp, and we lay out all the stuff we've brought, and then we tell them, whatever you need, it's yours," end of quote. Let's move over now to the reading room and look at our favorite reads of 2018. The first one is Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday. In this daring novel's opening section, a young editor and aspiring writer falls in love with a much older man, a sly, sagacious, and stratospherically famous fictional stand-in for the late Philip Roth, whom Halliday had dated. Halliday's perceptiveness and pitch-perfect dialogue imbue their relationship with elegance and verve. Their affair prompts the question, how do you make space for yourself with someone whose stature dwarfs your own? The second part is an elegiac first-person account of an Iraqi American economist detained at Heathrow on the way to find his brother in Kurdistan. Learning how these disparate plots intersect narratively and thematically is but one of the book's many pleasures. Another one of the favorite reads of 2018 is An American Marriage by Tayari Jones. This penetrating portrait of a young couple torn apart by a false rape accusation and the biases of our justice system has propelled master storyteller Jones into the top ranks of fiction writers. Upon selecting it as an Oprah's Book Club pick, Oprah said, quote, "It's among Tayari's many gifts that she can touch us soul to soul with her words," end of quote. Whether describing an ostensibly mundane trip to visit in-laws or composing epistolary confessions from prison, Jones enthralls and bids us to open our eyes. And the next title is Clock Dance by Anne Tyler. An Anne Tyler novel is best experienced beneath a favored quilt, with no interruptions from people asking when dinner will be ready. Tyler's 22nd work is another exquisite tale of a woman who's led a quiet life with few expectations until one day she realizes it isn't enough. What happens after Willa has this epiphany and relocates to a city thousands of miles away to care for a child that's not her own is beside the point. What keeps us glued are the lovely, intricate details. The depiction of human emotion as odd and splendid, and the tiny flickers of hope that feel like bursts of joy. The next title is How to Love a Jamaican by Alex Arthurs. When an international student turns up dead in an Iowa college, a Jamaican runner recruited to school is overcome with dread. Both because of the grisly nature of the murder and because the crime seems to solidify her mother's anxiety, quote, that she would lose her daughter tragically in America, a place that took daughters and later spit out their bones, end quote. From the daughter's perspective, of course, their mother's traditions, ambitions, and jealousies will be what consumes them. The essence of author's often devastating, always beautiful short fiction collection can be found in its finally tender illumination of the mother-daughter bond and of both sides of the divide between Caribbean parents and their Americanized children. The next title, The Overstory by Richard Powers. Majestic oaks, gold leaf aspens, delicate willows. What if our forests communed in a mystical dimension a twig away from our own? In a sweeping, inventive masterpiece, part speculative storytelling, part environmental manifesto, 9 characters team up to protect virgin forests from Oregon to Brooklyn, and trees are both the victims and the heroes of the epic battle. The next title, Those Who Knew, by Idra Novi. The island setting of Novi's provocative page-turner goes unnamed, granting both the place and the novel a glimmering ethereality. But the themes brought to light are as clear and familiar as our newspaper's front pages, specifically the accountability of men in power. The timely tale centers on a popular progressive senator who years earlier assaulted and nearly killed the woman he was seeing, incidents only a handful of people know about. In prose as taut and lithe as gossamer, Novi, a poet and translator of Clarice Lispector, weaves a wondrous web of personal and political intrigue, featuring singular characters all negotiating the costs of keeping silent. The next title is The Feral Detective by Jonathan Lethem. In the wake of the 2016 election, Phoebe quits her job at the New York Times to search for a mentor's missing daughter. Amid the crowded freeways and blanched light of L.A., she hires a strangely sexy lone wolf PI whose pet possum sleeps in his desk drawer. Their quest to find the runaway takes them through a desert swarming with Burning Man-esque outlaws and abandoned mining camps and the occasional reference to Eddie Sedgwick and Leonard Cohen. The author of Motherless Brooklyn gives the missing girl genre his own quirky, entrancing spin in this pan to SoCal noir in which Trump's America is the scene of the crime. The next title, Everything Here is Beautiful, by Mira T. Lee. Quote, our baby was born with a round face and dark curls and 2 eyes like lying down teardrops, end of quote, observes Yona, whose wife, Lucia, has a mental illness that sends her soaring to emotional heights, then crashing back down. So many of Lee's sentences cry out to be underlined, reread, and shared. Quote, the warmth of her house smelled suspicious, like vitamins and beef broth and soap, end of quote. But proof of this debut novelist's immense talent can also be found in her ability to pierce us with Lucia's pain and warm us with a sister's fierce devotion. The next title is Lake Success by Gary Steingart. On the Road meets MAGA. In a rollicking novel that compresses our troubled zeitgeist in a time capsule for the ages. Armed with his collection of rare watches, Barry Cohen, a 43-year-old finance bro, flees a failing business and a floundering family to go greyhound across America on the lam from his own conscience. Steingart's comic flourishes render Barry a sympathetic man-child in a land promised solely to the alpha dogs among us. And finally, Unsheltered by Barbara Kingsolver. After magazine editor Willa and her professor husband lose their jobs and are forced to move into a ramshackle house inherited from a relative, they discover it's not just their home that needs a total down-to-the-studs renovation. Kingsolver, whose novels have shown her to be as much activist as artist, here brilliantly captures both the price of profound change and how it can pave the way not only for future generations, but also for a radiant, unexpected expansion of the heart. Oh, wait, there's one more title, Educated by Tara Westover. After her Mormon survivalist parents retreated with her into the Idaho wilderness, tending herbs and skinning deer, rejecting medical care and other outside support, Westover taught herself science and grammar and plotted her escape. Like Hillbilly Elegy, this memoir thrillingly evokes the exultant climb out of poisonous isolation and into the life of the mind. I turn the page and there's one more. This title is Pretend I'm Dead by Jen Began. Outside the Needle Exchange, where house cleaner Mona meets Mr. Disgusting, the recovering junkie she falls for, a sign reads, "If God gives you lemons, find a new God." Began's rid-ticklingly funny, sad debut is replete with such melancholy witticisms. She works magic in the space between hilarity and heartbreak. The New Mexico sky, under which she hopes to scrub away the dirt of her traumatic past, is blithe, concentrated blue, the color of Windex. Absurdly affecting Began's first novel, Think Grace Paley, by way of Sarah Silverman, is a marvel. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.